Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to new government reforms in Iraq. We consider if there's a warming of relations between Russia and Saudi Arabia. We'll be learning how to improve our emotional intelligence.
How you are aware of yourself, how you regulate negative impulses, and how you are motivated for reasons beyond money.
And U.S. founding fathers hold a musical debate on Broadway. It's all ahead on The Voice of America. Iraqi politics are changing with a new initiative by Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, a change that cuts out guaranteed top posts for Iraq's many ethnic and sectarian groups. International Edition's Jeffrey Young is following this story, joins us now here in the studio. Jeffrey, what's the big shakeup in Baghdad?
Hi, Susan. To get a sense of the impact of Prime Minister al-Abadi's changes, which eliminate three vice president posts and a deputy prime ministership, I spoke with John Jenkins, the executive director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies Bahrain office.
It surprised me that it went through so fast. The original distribution of vice president posts was to bring all the different communities together within a government and give them all a stake in its success. Originally, this was vice presidential, then it became a principle for the distribution of posts within the government itself. And we have the same distribution between the president, the speaker, and the prime minister. It looked similar to the Lebanese system. Abadi himself has not shown a willingness to take this sort of bold decision before, so he must think he has some sort of support for this. What gives me pause is the fact that Maliki himself has come out in favour. At the same time, the Supreme Court is busy eroding the powers of Parliament. So, and this is a time when sectarian divisions in Iraq are as serious as they've ever been.
Iraq's Parliament voted unanimously in favour of approving al-Abadi's reform package. There are winners and losers in this proposition, yet we have a unanimous vote.
I think the protests about services or the lack of services are genuine. I mean, these are protests we've seen before. They were suppressed by the Maliki government in 2010, 2011, and it led then, of course, to the clearing of the protest sites in Hawija and Ramadi and Fallujah, which led indirectly to the resurgence of Daesh, the Islamic State. So this is something we've seen before. It's genuine. There's a real problem with the heart of government. No politician in Iraq is going to want to be seen, I think, to be standing against popular protests, particularly when they're protests which are led by Shia, not Sunni, as they mostly were in 2010. So maybe this is a protective stance by Iraqi politicians. The question arises, of course, is if this proceeds, what sort of government do you get at the end of it? And there is a question about the constitutionality, for example, of not having a single vice president. You might not want three, but you probably need one. Although this has happened faster than I thought it was going to do, I think there are still real issues ahead about how this ends.
How do you plan to rout the corruption that is essentially so embedded in the system that it is the system?
It's a very good question, and we've seen various ministers over the last 10 years leave their posts, leave Iraq, having made reportedly huge amounts of money. Without actually having delivered anything. And if you look at various indices on corruption, Iraq at the moment figures very highly as a country where corruption is rife.
That was John Jenkins, Executive Director of the Bahrain Office of the London-headquartered International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Iraqi politics is lively, to say the least.
And while all of this is going on, the Islamic State is tearing up the country.
Thanks for stopping by, Jeff.
Thanks, Susan.
Let's find out what people are saying about the Iraqi government changes on social media. Michael Lippin is here in the studio with us with details. Michael, what's the latest?
Hi, Susan. Well, I can tell you that one person who's talking about the government reshuffle on Twitter is the Iraqi Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi. His handle is @HaiderAlAbadi, and he's got 51,000 followers, but also doesn't follow anyone himself. This is what Mr. Abadi tweeted a short time ago. I congratulate all Iraqis on today's milestone achievement and pledge my unwavering commitment to the path of reform at any cost. His reforms got some praise from the Twitter account of the Europe-Iraqi Freedom Association. That's a non-governmental organization of Iraqi expatriates based in Brussels who seek what they call the restoration of freedom, justice, and human rights in Iraq. The EIFA's Twitter handle is @EUIraq, and this is what their message says. EIFA welcomes Abadi reform package, but demands more. Hashtag Abadi does it. Hashtag Iraq reforms. They also included a link to a web statement in which they called on Mr. Abadi to also prosecute former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki for crimes against humanity, and the Iraqi expatriates demanded that the Iraqi leader evict Iran from all areas in which they say it has interfered in Iraq.
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists has spotted the most distant galaxy ever seen. Astrophysicists from the California Institute of Technology say that the galaxy called EGS 8P7 is the youngest such celestial object ever confirmed by spectrographic analysis. A spectrograph allows scientists to observe a spectrum of light or radiation from any source. This distant galaxy is being seen now as it was when the universe was less than 600 million years old. The astrophysicists say that finding galaxy EGS 8P7 provides new insight into how the universe evolved during its first few hundred million years of existence. They also say that the discovery brings scientists a giant step closer to looking back in time to the Big Bang. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Russia, pressing to mediate the Syrian conflict, has hosted the Saudi foreign minister for talks that revealed sharp differences over the fate of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov pushed for engaging Syrian government forces in international efforts to fight Islamic State militants, but his Saudi counterpart, Adel al-Jubeir, firmly rejects any role for Assad, saying Assad is part of the problem and not part of the solution. The two did, however, agree on the need to encourage Syrian opposition groups to pool their efforts in the search for a peaceful settlement. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shinawi discussed the significance of the Russian-Saudi rapprochement with Mark Katz, professor of government at George Mason University, and he joins me here in the studio. Welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Mohammed, Saudis rarely rely on Russia in solving regional problems. What prompted them to get closer to Russia this time?
Professor Katz wouldn't call this warming in Saudi-Russian relations rapprochement, but rather lessening of tensions between the two sides.
I think that the one factor that has helped encourage this is the recognition that the ISIS is a common threat in Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere, and that it would be good if they could work together.
Katz also said that the Saudis are not happy about the U.S. deal with Iran, and they are using Moscow to show the United States that they have other options too. As for combating the Islamic State group, he said Russia wants to counter this group but does not want to get involved directly.
Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov said the war in Yemen should end and that Russia has contacts with some of the warring factions there. Would that mean Russia will have some role in ending the Yemeni conflict?
Well, so according to Professor Katz, having contacts with some parties in Yemen does not necessarily mean a useful role.
You have to have more than contacts. You have to either be able to threaten parties to change their behavior, or you have to be able to induce them by offering benefits. And I don't think that in the Yemeni context, Moscow can do either.
Professor Katz said Russian-Saudi talks could, however, provide the Saudis an opportunity to acquire a nuclear reactor if they desire to have one, or at least diversify their weapon system with the Russian arms. He said that they discussed also ways to improve coordination in countering the slumping of oil prices that resulted in substantial financial losses for both Saudi Arabia and Russia.
What Russia would like to see is for the Saudis to reduce their output. I think what the Saudis would like to see is the Russians reduce their output, and I don't think that either of them is going to do this. And, of course, neither of them can control American output, which is the new factor. So, you know, it's conceivable that they could cooperate in this area, but they've had plenty of opportunity in the past to do so, and they just haven't.
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for visiting with us and for bringing us some analysis on that subject.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, are things turning around for Greece? Sharpening our emotional intelligence, and hip-hop goes historical on Broadway. Greek officials say the government has reached an agreement with international creditors on terms for a new bailout. Ken Brademeyer of the VOA Economics Desk has joined me here in the studio. He has all the details. Welcome back, Ken.
Good to be here. I can tell you a little bit about this agreement. It says in the Greek government, it's been a long fight to come to a new accord with its creditors, but today they reached a $94 billion bailout agreement. It's not quite done yet. It has to be signed off on by its creditors, such as its neighbors in Europe, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. But they needed to do this soon because Greece always seems to be up against some kind of a deadline. This time it's August 20th when they have to pay more than $3 billion back to the European Central Bank.
So there are some critics of this pact. What are they saying?
Critics would be, to a large degree, internal in Greece. Members of the prime minister's Syriza ruling party, who feel that he has turned on what he ran for election on, which was to do away with the austerity that this new agreement requires. Now, it appears, however, that there's not going to be enough opposition to the deal to kill it. It will pass with some Syriza support, as well as other Greek lawmakers from other parties.
And I remember when last time you visited us, you were saying some of the Greek people feel really put upon by all this.
Certainly that's the case. Austerity has a bad name in Greece at this point. It's even worse than that. Greece has gone through a tumultuous period and has had to previously impose lots of austerity measures. And this particular bailout requires even more tax increases, pension cuts, and cuts in government spending, which a lot of Greeks have depended on and feel because the earlier austerity didn't improve their lot much. They're saying, why should we endure more? But that's what this deal calls for.
Yeah. Perhaps you'll refresh our memories on what kind of situation in Greece has brought on the need for all these deals.
Greece has been in economic turmoil for 5 years now. This is the third bailout in that time. And if you put this one with the other two, it's now a total of $359 billion, which is a huge amount for a country the size of Greece. It's just 2% of the economy in the European Union, but is deeply in arrears, and it's going to be a long time before it can get itself cleared again. These bailouts, if you can think on it on a personal terms, would be like getting a new credit card to pay back old credit card debts,
yeah,
if people can look at it from their own personal lives. And that's why it's a very difficult sort of situation for the Greeks.
Okay, well, thank you, Ken, for that update on the Greek bailout. Always nice to have you here.
Good to be here.
Well, I heard about something today I've never heard about before, EQ, emotional intelligence. This EQ is supposed to help us in all sorts of ways. And to explain it all, from Florida is Karen Nutter, a corporate and lifestyle coach and author of the new book, The Power of EQ, Stronger Leadership Through Emotional Intelligence. Well, welcome to our show, Karen.
Thank you so much.
Oh, first off the bat, I don't know much about this at all. Matter of fact, I know nothing about it. So I'll ask you first off, can you explain to us what is emotional intelligence?
Well, emotional intelligence, which is often referred to by the acronym EQ or EI, is the ability to sense, understand, and effectively apply the power and acumen of emotion so that you yourself can facilitate high levels of productivity and collaboration. So it's basically how you understand yourself and then how well you are at understanding yourself and others.
How can we get more EQ?
The way to get more EQ is to work with a coach or a mentor who can be honest with you or maybe who implements an assessment like I do that helps the person understand maybe where their areas are that they could work on and then how to better those areas.
And how can this help us if we improve our EQ?
Well, it's going to help you in all areas of life. The five components of EQ are self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, empathy, and social skills. So the first three, the self-awareness, self-regulation, and motivation, are the key to understanding yourself, how you are aware of yourself, how you regulate negative impulses, and how you are motivated for reasons beyond money. The next two, empathy and social skills, are how you interact with others, how much empathy you have towards others, and how you are able to manage networks and manage yourself within those networks. EQ can be elevated at any age. Your IQ stops.
This sounds like something that would be real good for a retreat, you know, where you go to the countryside with a bunch of other people and some instructors and just spend a couple days working on this sort of thing. Well, does more EQ necessarily mean more happiness in our lives, or can sometimes this sort of irritate your friends and family?
No, because the more EQ you have, the more you understand yourself. And for example, in corporate America, a true leader probably has a high level of EQ. You put two leaders together, and one who has maybe advanced degrees, a PhD, the other one maybe has a master's, which is certainly a nice degree to have, but maybe their EQ is higher. People are going to more want to follow that person than they are the one with the PhD whose maybe EQ is lower. So this is one area that the level of education does not necessarily come into play. It's more of self-awareness.
Well, thanks, Karen, for joining us today, and good luck with your book. Let me mention the title again, if you will, The Power of EQ, Stronger Leadership Through Emotional Intelligence. It sounds like we all can benefit from this.
Yes, we can, and thank you so much for your time.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
The disappearance of forests leads to erosion, soil degradation, and other environmental problems. But much of what has been lost may be regained simply by planting trees. John Leary is the executive director of Trees for the Future.
Planting trees is a real critical anchor in the community, and it's kind of a real essential thing to return tree cover to the degraded lands.
Leary says they have planted more than 100 million trees since their inception about 25 years ago, and they are especially focused on sub-Saharan Africa.
And we guide farmers through the process of planting fast-growing and thorny trees that help revitalize and stabilize fields.
Last year, Trees for the Future put more than 20 million trees to the ground.
Really trying to help 4,000 families plant their way out of poverty.
The plan, says Leary, is to grow the program to reach 10,000 families in the next few years. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Thursday evening, while the Republicans were holding their first U.S. presidential debate on television, this country's founding fathers were holding their own debates on Broadway with the opening of Hamilton, a new hip-hop musical by and starring Lin-Manuel Miranda. As Jeff London reports, the buzz has been growing for the show about Alexander Hamilton. He's the guy on the U.S. $10 bill since the show opened last winter off-Broadway, where it had a sold-out run.
Lin-Manuel Miranda has been working on Hamilton for 6 years. It started with him sitting on a beach, reading Ron Chernow's 832-page biography of the country's first Treasury Secretary, and realizing the story sang to him.
I feel like a mosquito that hit an artery. That's how I felt when I read Ron Chernow's book. I just thought, Hamilton's life story contains multitudes, particularly in the way Ron unlocked it, in the way that Hamilton is sort of the proto-American immigrant story, the trauma of his early years, and how that kind of created a crack in the foundation.
Biographer Chernow says he was initially skeptical that his book could be turned into a musical, much less one that uses rap as its main source of expression. But he agreed to meet with Miranda.
He came over to my house. He sat on my living room couch. He started snapping his fingers, and he sang the opening song. And I absolutely marveled at what he'd done, because I realized that he had condensed the first 40 pages of my book accurately into a 4.5-minute song.
Miranda performed that opening number at a poetry evening at the White House in 2009.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter. By 14, they placed him in charge of the trade and charter.
Hamilton's life really was like a Dickensian novel, filled with coincidence and reversals of fortune. He brought himself out of poverty, immigrated to New York, and became a leading figure in the American Revolution as an aide to George Washington. He wrote most of the Federalist Papers, created the National Bank, was involved in the first national sex scandal, and managed to create enemies, from Thomas Jefferson and James Madison to Aaron Burr, who famously killed Hamilton in a duel.
The fights we had then in the formation of our country will be the fights we have 100 years from now, 200 years from now. They will be, what is the role of the state versus the role of the larger country? What is our responsibility to other countries that are not our own? The two battles, cabinet battles in our show, are about those two things, because they're going to outlive us. We'll always be having those fights.
In telling this story from over 200 years ago, Miranda and his director, Thomas Kail, made the decision to have the show performed by a multiracial, multi-ethnic cast.
Tommy's goal was to eliminate any distance between a contemporary audience and this story. That's what the music aims to do. That's what the entire production aims to do. And so it's a story of America then told by what America looks like now.
I want to be in the room where it happens, the room where it happens.
One of the repeated lines in Hamilton is, "Who lives, who dies, who tells your story?" And Lin-Manuel Miranda wants to make sure that this story is told by as many different people as possible once the run on Broadway is done years from now. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
50 years ago this month, American democracy was born anew with the signing into law of the U.S. Voting Rights Act. Forged in the crucible of the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, when black Americans and other minorities organized to end decades of discrimination against them, the law both reaffirmed their basic rights as citizens and revolutionized our political system. The act, signed by President Lyndon Johnson on August 6, 1965, affirmed blacks and other minorities' right to vote, a right that came with the fall of slavery a century earlier, but was often denied by political means. It struck down many procedures used in various cities and states to maintain white political control by limiting the votes of minorities. These included requirements that voters pay a tax to cast a ballot and be able to prove that they could read and write. It also provided federal oversight of elections where black voter registration was low, and it empowered the Attorney General to investigate other tactics used to suppress the vote. Almost overnight, black voter registration grew exponentially, most markedly in the South, where discrimination had been most pronounced. Since then, Congress has followed up by adding amendments several times, most notably by requiring bilingual elections, thus enfranchising foreign speakers as well as racial minorities. In the years to follow, our political leadership, from city halls to state houses to the U.S. Capitol and the White House, grew more diverse. By the mid-1990s, these moves and the broadening of the U.S. electorate they fostered had culminated in an almost complete realignment of our two major political parties. As the nation celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act and the great strides we've taken as a nation since, we also remember those who worked to make the law and its ideals a reality, securing for all the full blessings and privileges of American life.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.